Good morning. My name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Elise Passion. Elise is a poet. She is an editor, and she is a professor of poetry and of literature at the Art Institute of Chicago. She's also a resident of Harbor Country. Elise Passion, With Respect. Elise, how are you today?
Very well, thank you.
Good, good. Elise, you are a resident of this area.
I am indeed.
Yeah, and how long have you been out here?
Well, we've been coming out here probably around, I'd say, 7 or 8 years. Mm-hmm. We started renting in Lakeside, and then we ended up purchasing our own house in Harbert about 4 years ago.
But you're also a resident of Chicago.
And I also live in Chicago full-time.
Family?
Yes, yes, married, and we have an 11-year-old daughter and an 8-year-old son.
All right. Okay. Now, you came from where? Where are you from originally?
I was born and raised here in Chicago.
Really?
Yes.
All right. And I'm going to ask you how long ago. That's not fair. But what was it like growing up? How did you get into poetry?
My mother was a famous prima ballerina named Maria Tallchief, mm-hmm. and she was married to George Balanchine. They began the New York City Ballet together in the late 40s, and she later married my father, and that's how our family ended up in Chicago. My father was born and raised in Chicago, and I grew up as a backstage baby, so I watched my mother dance around the world, and I was their only child, and I knew at a very young age that the intent of your life was to discover something that you were passionate about. And I was very lucky that when I was young, I had a very vivid imagination, and when I started to learn how to read and how to write, I began writing, and I began writing at the age of 8. My parents gave me the Oxford Book of Poetry, and I discovered a poem by William Blake called The Tiger.
Oh, Tiger, Tiger,
exactly,
burning bright.
Exactly, exactly. And so I memorized this poem and came home from school one day, recited it to my mother, and I think from that day on I was really hooked, and I was writing poems, short stories, plays. Continued writing through high school, and then I went to college, went to Harvard, and really then focused on poetry and studied with these wonderful poets, Seamus Heaney, Robert Fitzgerald, who translated the Iliad and the Odyssey, Richard Tillinghast. So I was very fortunate to figure out what I wanted to do early in life.
Well, you are lucky because, you know, one of the things that I have learned in doing this show and also through life is, and in my own life, I've found that we don't necessarily get to where we are by direct lines. In fact, very few people that I know have come to wherever they are, whether they're at 15 years old or 100 years old, by going direct lines. We take zigs and zags, and sometimes things happen that direct us one way or the other. Did any of those fit with you?
You know, it's interesting. I was just interviewed for a book Betsy Storm is doing in Chicago on spirituality, and I and you and I were talking before this show discussing those zigs and zags, and I felt that Betsy was looking for that too, some awakening or some catastrophe. Knock on wood, I actually have been pretty directed. Probably the one zig, I've always known I wanted to be a writer, and again, I sort of owe it to my mother, who was this model artist in my mind. I think that my one zigger-zag was leaving. I did a doctorate at Oxford University, and I had intended to become an editor of a magazine. I wanted to be the poetry editor of The New Yorker or the editor of the Paris Review, poetry editor of the Paris Review. And I ended up being hired as the executive director of the Poetry Society of America. So that might have been one shift that I didn't expect, to run a nonprofit, which I did for 13 years and loved it. And then maybe the other one was probably I never expected I would end up living in Chicago as an adult, because I was living in Cambridge, Massachusetts, then Oxford, England, then New York City. So I don't think I ever really intended to come back home to Chicago. And my kids are going to the same school that I went to, which is Francis Parker. And my father went to the same school, Francis Parker. And so I think I didn't expect that I would end up going back to that same place. So in that sense, maybe, you know, my life didn't end up going in such a dramatic different direction than I probably would have imagined when I was in graduate school living in England.
You know, if I had a dollar for every person I've known in my life who had made a vow early on, I will not come back to this neighborhood. I am off on my own. I'm going to be independent. I'm going to establish my own place in life. I would be a rich man. And I don't know that it applies to you, but I do know that the concept of home. To the extent that a person like yourself, who is, as you say, a stage child, or can I say stage brat? I mean, be backstage.
I don't know if I was a brat, but
no,
definitely
no.
Backstage something.
The reason I mention that is because I did an interview recently with a woman, Christine Duboulay Ellis, who was the daughter of a fighter pilot. And married a fighter pilot. And I so I made the point. I said, well, no, so we could call you an Air Force brat. And she said, well, from England. Yeah, we didn't call it that. But at any rate, the point here is that we do come back to our roots many times. And I've seen it. I've heard, talked to people who say, you know, I didn't want to come back here, but I decided it was a good place to raise my children. So there's sort of a gravitation. And often, it's where you were happy.
Well, it's interesting. I never made the vow not to return to Chicago because I have such wonderful memories of growing up there, and I love Chicago. So I was never one of those people that felt I never wanted to go home. I never went, you know, it was never something that I felt negative feelings about. This is probably if somebody had asked me when I was 28 years old, where would you end up? I probably would have thought Cambridge, Massachusetts, or New York City. I probably would have ended up, in my imagination, on the East Coast. But I'm very happily
Midwesterner?
Yes, I suppose so. And I'm very happy that we are living there. And when my husband and I met, he was living in Chicago and I was living in New York. And we were vacillating. We were trying to figure out, do I move back to Chicago where his job was, or does he move to New York where my job was? And it just made sense to come home, be with the grandparents, or we didn't have children as of yet, but if we did have children, we'd have grandparents in Chicago. At that time, all four grandparents were living. It's not a decision I regret at all. So very happy. And you're right. It's really lovely to raise your children where you yourself were raised. So, yes.
Well, you know, it's you touch it, human beings, I think, are great. They can be great in terms of worldly sorts of things. That is, you can be rich, you can be president of the United States, whatever, and you don't really have to be a solid person inside. But to be a solid person inside, you've got to be. There's got to be a core that you are able, that you're in touch with. And I often think that whether it's a core that you want to talk about or not, the author is a person, and especially the poet is a person who is in touch with their core, or at least is trying to find their core. And part of a person's core is where they came from. I mean, I think of Emily Dickinson. Didn't get very far away from where she first she was when she was young, as I recall.
Absolutely, she was a recluse.
A recluse.
She stayed in Amherst her
That's
whole
right.
life.
And yet she produced the most fascinating poetry and insights into people, into nature, mm-hmm. and to the relationships between the two.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going to shift to dancing for just a minute. Besides Christine Duboulay Ellis, I don't know if you recognize the name Anna Pavlova.
Of course, yes.
Okay, and she was one of the great ballerinas of the first part of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you knew this, but one of her prime dancers, partners, dancing partners, was Laurent Novikoff. Do you know the name?
Sounds familiar.
All right. Laurent lived here in New Buffalo.
Huh.
And his wife, after he passed, continued to live here. Their son was my chief investigator.
Wow.
When I was prosecutor.
And is any relation to Vladimir?
No.
Is it Nabokov?
It is Novikoff.
Novikoff, okay.
Yeah, Novikoff. Now, the fascinating thing about that was, I would think, good Lord, I mean, Anna Pavlova, one of the great performing dancers of all time, ending up with a New Buffalo connection.
Mm.
But here's an interesting side bit of it. His name was Andrew Novikoff, was my chief investigator, had two sons, and they lived here in the St. Joe area. One day he said, John, you know, I'm very frustrated. I said, really? What's the problem? He said, I've got two sons. I'm trying to teach them and tell them about their background, how I escaped from Russia when I was 5 years old. I was there when the Reds took over in the Revolution. How my parents smuggled me out. I went to Westminster School in London, and I was the classmate of Kim Philby, one of the great spies that did great damage to the British government. I have a room. I have a huge room. He walked me into it. It's a huge room of trophies, of memorabilia that his mother and dad acquired from all their his dancing with Pavlova around the world. He said, "I can't get them interested in it."
Mm.
And I thought, what a sad thing, because he was afraid that his legacy, his psychological genes were going to die off.
Mm-hmm.
The fascinating thing was, next generation, these two kids grew up, one became a police officer instead of, you know, a juvenile delinquent, and the other became a dentist, and they became fascinated with their background.
Ah.
And so he finally, at long last, had the ability to sit down and tell them about living around the world.
Mm-hmm.
You have that ability now. And are your children interested in this?
Well, my children, I think that they're very aware of who their grandmother is.
Mm-hmm.
And we have brought them back to Oklahoma, which is where mm-hmm. my mother was born and raised, Fairfax, mm-hmm. Oklahoma. We've tried to expose them to Osage tradition because my mother's half Osage. I'm a quarter,
mm-hmm.
so we're legally Osage. Our kids are 1/8.
Mm-hmm.
So we've returned every year. There are dances that our family attends, the Gray Horse Dances, and we all have received our Osage names, mm-hmm. which was quite an exciting moment, I know, for myself and for the children. And interestingly, I was teaching at Fish Trap in Oregon. I think it was back in 1996 or 1997 with a filmmaker named Sandy Osawa. And we were the theme of the conference was circling back, and it was mm-hmm. you know, really focused on Native Americans. And after my presentation, she said to me, has anyone ever made a documentary about your mother? And I said, no, they haven't. And Sandy worked on this documentary for about 10 years. And she was able to go see my mother receive the National Medal for the Arts.
Mm-hmm.
There's document, you know, and she was basically in Oklahoma when our son Stephen received his Osage name. So it's really quite interesting how art reflects life, because now we have, you know, we have, as you were talking about your friend, we have artifacts. We have this film that my kids can see, mm-hmm. and reminding them of their Osage heritage, reminding them when they were very little that they received their Osage names. I try to write about these experiences in my poems. So I think that either unconsciously or consciously, they are ingesting, they are absorbing their ancestry, you know, mm-hmm. but because they're just mm-hmm. surrounded by it. They've mm-hmm. got,
and they can't get away.
They can't get away. And I think ultimately they're proud. We were just at the Bridgman Aquatic Center yesterday, and both of the kids were having lessons, and the teacher Susan was saying to Stephen, the eight-year-old son, okay, now when you kick, put your foot like a ballet dancer. And I know she didn't know who his grandmother was, but I thought to myself, Stephen knows what that means.
A plié is a...
exactly.
All right, we're talking to Elise Passion, and we're talking about her background and her life growing up and her family. We'll be back in just a moment. We're back now with Elise Passion. Elise, a poet, a mother of two children, and the daughter of Maria Tallchief, who everybody, I'm sure, listening to this program knows is one of the greatest American dancers of all time. And but you are a person in your own right. And you have accomplished an immense amount in your very young life. And besides the most important thing, I'm sure, being a parent, is you'll probably find is more important than anything else. But in addition to that, you're a poet, and you're a creator of anthologies, and you're a professor. Let's start with poetry for you started with writing, doing your own writing. But then it quickly developed, you talked about becoming an editor of a magazine. So you're thinking about communication to others of this passion that you have. Now, how many people tease you about passion and passion? A lot of people?
Yes.
All right, I won't do that anymore.
Okay.
But how many people have that? I mean, how did that passion come about to communicate poetry?
Well, again, you know, it happened at an early age. And it wasn't anything conscious. When I was in high school, I had two. I have to say that I really credit, and I'm very grateful to my teachers throughout my life. Mm-hmm. And I had two amazing teachers. I mean, many amazing teachers, but two in particular at Francis Parker in Chicago. One of whom was a former monk named mm-hmm. Bill Duffy, who had just come to Francis Parker to teach British literature.
Mm-hmm.
So he introduced me to the poems of William Butler Yeats in his British literature class. And my second teacher taught American literature, and her name was Marie Stone. Sadly, neither of them are with us anymore, but Mrs. Stone was my advisor, and she really inspired me. And all of us who were students of Mrs. Stone can attest to the fact that she really, you know, inspired us to discover what it is we could accomplish and try to pursue that in our lives. Anyway, I believe probably that it was, I'm sure Mrs. Stone was somehow behind this, but the literary magazine was no longer in existence at our high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure because of Mrs. Stone, we ended up bringing it back to life. And I was the editor of this literary magazine called Prince, Prints. I don't know if there's still a literary magazine at Parker or not. But so it started in high school that I became the editor of this literary magazine. And then when I went to college, I became the poetry editor of the Harvard Advocate. And then when I went to Oxford, again, we started a magazine, myself and three other poets, under the tutelage of another great mentor in my life, John Fuller, the poet John Fuller. And that magazine is called Oxford Poetry. That's still alive and kicking. And that was begun originally in 1927 by W.H. Auden. So I guess that to answer your question, I have always just gravitated toward editing. I've always been very excited about discovering the work of new writers. I know that at Oxford Poetry, we publish for the first time poets such as Glenn Maxwell, who's well known in England, John Lanchester, again English, who became a novelist, Mick Imlaugh, who was one of my co-editors, Bernard O'Donohue, many British poets. I don't know. We published Walter Kern, who interestingly became a prose writer and wrote the screenplay or the novel that Up in the Air was based on.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always just loved looking at works by other writers and then bringing those works to the attention of the public.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I'm answering your question.
You are. No, this is exactly what I'm interested in, because many of the people that you mention, I don't know them. I don't know them personally.
I think probably most people in America.
No. I'm saying I don't know them personally.
Mm-hmm.
But if they were sitting here, I would imagine that many of them would be more concerned with producing their own work rather than displaying the works of others, is the point I want to make.
Mm-hmm.
Parenthetically, my brother became a journalist at age 7.
Mm.
And his journalism was revolving around doing a neighborhood newspaper in which he said things like, I'll be happy to tell you who was at Mrs. Jones' house last night. And he, at 7 years old, he was causing a lot of problems in our neighborhood because this little paper was filled with interesting stuff. But he went on to Northwestern and got his journalism there. And
now what neighborhood was that?
That was in the western side of Chicago, in
okay.
LaGrange.
Uh-huh.
And he went to Medill School of Journalism in Northwestern. And he was going to escape from the genetic trap in our family of becoming lawyers. All the male members were lawyers. But he later, by the way, collapsed and gave up and became a lawyer.
Oh, wow.
But he used his journalism skills as in his role in Washington to write. But the point I want to make is that he was concerned with communication of information.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was impressed with is, by a number of your works, is just that you are, you have Poetry Speaks Who I Am. We have Poetry Speaks to Children. We have other anthologies of other people's poetry, which I think is extremely admirable because you're giving a chance for people whose names are not household names to get some oxygen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that's an unselfish thing. Whether you do it unselfishly or not, I don't know. But I can tell you, I consider it to be unselfish, letting other people get some air.
Well, you know, it all started, so I was editing these journals, and then I again sort of fell into it, as I think about it now. After I left graduate school, I became the executive director of the Poetry Society of America. And in 1992, we launched a program called Poetry in Motion,
mm-hmm.
where we put poetry in the subways and buses,
mm-hmm.
Starting in New York City, and it became a nationwide program in 1996. And one of the first, the first anthology, which I co-edited, was Poetry in Motion, based on the first 100 poems to appear in the subways and buses.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did a second anthology with Norton, Poetry in Motion from Coast to Coast, based on the poems that we were doing across the country. So that's how those anthologies started. And then I was very lucky to, again, I feel like, you know, many things have happened. I feel that I was in the right place at the right time. We have been doing a series. When I was running the Poetry Society of America, to continue your point, I did feel very strongly about putting poetry at the crossroads of American life. That mm-hmm. became our mission. And I did feel, and I think that it could be, you know, I think that that could be a problem as a writer. It is probably, you're better off as a writer if you are focusing more attention on your own writing. But there is a part of me that loves to edit, and I love to bring the work of other poets to other people's attention. And running the Poetry Society of America, one thing that we did was to try to surprise people with poetry in the midst of their mm-hmm. daily lives. But to continue, I'm sort of going on different strands right now, but to continue with your point, I think that it is a lot easier for me to promote the work of other poets. So I know that when I was running the Poetry Society, I could always say I'm the executive director of the Poetry Society of America and be shy at, you know, be quiet about my own writing. So not sort of, and I, it's a tough balancing act.
Why?
I think that I feel great respect for people who write poetry, and I feel that you know, it's almost like a sacred art form that you really have to deserve the mantle. mm-hmm. And it's just much simpler for me to be able to be in the world. I mean, I love being in the world and reading my own work, but I think, you know, I think that there's a part of me that is sort of shy, and it's easier to be out there talking about the work of other poets mm-hmm. than promoting my own work, maybe. I don't mm-hmm. know. I haven't really thought about it.
What's poetry for you? Now, I'm going to tell you that, yes, you're right, that poetry is not the form of communication that most people come in contact with, or at least they don't think they come in contact with. In fact, they do, but you know, they read newspapers, they read magazines, they read the internet, and they read novels and histories, and they say, well, poetry, well, I don't get this. But what is poetry? I mean, poetry has taken all different kinds of forms over the ages, from where it had to be rhyming couplets to other forms, blank verse and whatnot. What is it to you?
Well, to me, poetry is able, I mean, to write a poem is to be able to orchestrate time. So you're able to take a moment of an experience and translate that onto the page. And for me, nothing gives me greater pleasure than to be working on a poem, to be in the thick of writing a poem, and to be able, you know, time will stop for me as I write. So I may be working on a poem and have no notice that several hours have gone by, just sort of, you know, figuring out mm-hmm. the craft, the structure of the poem. I feel that, again, to look at the work of others, when we were putting poetry in the subways and buses, we were attempting to, and even with this new book, we just did this new book, Poetry Speaks Who I Am, and that was my point that I was trying to make a little earlier, which was that when we were doing these events, Poetry in Public Places, we did an event at Steppenwolf, Poetry and Drama, with Frank Bedart, John Mahoney, and Gwendolyn Brooks. And it was part of the Traffic series. And after that event, Tim Evans, who was running the Traffic series, said to me, this publisher at Sourcebooks, Dominique Rocca, is looking for someone to edit this new series called Poetry Speaks. So what I was saying is I was in the right place at the right time. So we started these series of anthologies, Poetry Speaks. And the latest one is called Poetry Speaks Who I Am. And part of our mission with that book was to grab the attention of teenagers and tweens with a poem mm-hmm. and to try to find visceral moments, to try to figure out what is it in the poem, when you read that poem, will stop your heart, you know, will make you feel like you want to cry, will make you want to laugh. So I think that, again, there's something, and again, this goes back to William Butler Yeats, that a poem begins with a deep-seated emotion. And you may work on it, you may craft it, and by the time you finish it, you may not know where that emotion started, but it all comes from something that moved you initially to write the poem. Mm-hmm. And we hope that as a reader, when you read that poem will also affect the reader in the same way. Robert Frost, I'm going to get this line wrong, said something like, no tears in the writer, no tears in the reader. Mm. So again, how is it that you connect as you're discussing connections? How can you as a writer connect, or how can I as an editor find poems that will help an audience connect, you know, with this poem? Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful poem that we led this new anthology, Poetry Speaks Who I Am, by a friend of mine who tragically passed away at a very young age, Jason Schinder. And the poem is called Eternity. And it's the first poem in Poetry Speaks Who I Am. And it's this idea of a poem being written 3,000 years ago and how a woman, you know, today is reading this poem, and he ends the poem with, and every time the poem is read, no matter what her situation or age, this is more or less what happens. You need to read the entire poem, but it's just this connection that this woman has with this poem, you know, with this poet who wrote the poem mm-hmm. 1,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the wonder of poetry, if you can find poems that can connect with people in mm-hmm. that way.
One of the things we'll talk about later is how poetry can affect the young. But right now, we're going to take a break. We're talking to Elise Passion, a poet, an editor of anthologies of poetry, and a saleswoman of poetry. We'll be right back. We're now back with Elise Passion, who is a poet and a resident of Harbor Country, and is an editor and communicator of the beauty and the importance of poetry. Well, I've got to tell a personal story here. I have, when I wanted to find something of yours, I found a book the other day called Poetry Speaks to Children. I opened it up, and I thought, OMG. This takes me back to when my daughter, who is now 25, was 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And at night, I would read her to sleep. And we tried different things. And I tried the boxcar children. Somebody reminded me of the horrors that I put her through with the first book I tried to read to her, which was The Last of the Mohicans by James Fenimore Cooper. And when I bought it, I thought it was such, this would be great. I loved this book when I was a kid. Well, she was 7 years old, and the language was 1850 language.
I know, the same situation happened to me.
Oh, man.
So my daughter.
My law partner said to me, I was telling her about this the other day, she said, you did what to your poor daughter? The James Fenimore Cooper at seven? Anyway.
Well, may I just, don't forget what you're saying, but the same thing happened to us. My parents were moving from their apartment in Chicago, and Dad said I could keep a box of books. So I kept all my favorite books. Mm-hmm. And we love to read to our children as well. And I remember taking out the Red Fairy book. I love those Andrew Lang fairy books. Mm-hmm. And I'd save them on this bookshelf for our daughter. And then I had The Secret Garden, which was a book I loved as a child. And I started reading these books to Alexandra, and I just realized that the prose was so archaic.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, not very well written. I hate to say it, but so flowery and so over the top. And I was trying to get my poor daughter to feel as enthusiastic as I did, you know, at the time when I read those books.
You can't, but you know, the sad thing is, Thomas Wolfe, you can't go home.
Mm-hmm.
You can't necessarily create those magic moments
mm-hmm.
again. But you try.
But you sometimes
but
can.
You try.
She
loves the
mixed up files of his Basil E. Frankenwheeler and
I love that one.
Harriet
that
the Spy and yes. The Phantom Tollbooth. So there
Don't
were some
one.
Of the books I loved that she still loves. But those little nuggets
yeah.
weren't the same.
Well, my daughter was very patient with me. Very patient. So when I would read these all of these things, she would finally fall asleep. Or sometimes she'd say, "Dad, maybe we can do something else tonight." So we tried everything. We had, as I said, we had the Boxcar Children, Nancy Drew, the Hardy Boys. I read her a biography just so she'd hear the human voice. Read her a biography of Barbara Bush. You know, where that came from, I don't know. It was just I grabbed it one night. But at any rate, where it was became really fun was in latter life is I used to read poetry to her,
right.
And we got to the point that we loved certain poems that we would repeat over and over again. One of them was Jabberwocky.
Oh, wonderful.
It was brillig and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wave, etc. And the other, another one was the Raven, quoth the Raven, nevermore.
Mm-hmm.
And so on. So, you know, she finally grew out of it. At about age 13, she said, "Enough is enough." And what we ended up with was, "Dad, I think I can now read myself to sleep," which is fine. But later on, I was talking to her. She was then in just going into high school, I guess, her first year of high school. And I said, "You know, Howie, what happened today? Nothing. What did you learn? Nothing." You probably haven't come to that stage yet. Your children probably still communicate to you.
No.
But there will come a time, I warn you.
We're there.
But at any rate, so I said this one day, I said, "Well, what happened?" She said, "Dad, you know, I've got to tell you something. Strangest thing happened today." "What's that?" Miss Campbell was teaching us English literature, and she came up to a point where she said, "Now, you probably have any of you heard of Lewis Carroll?" And a few kids, their hands sort of twitched. And she said that he wrote a poem called Jabberwocky. I'm sure that none of you know that. So is anybody here who knows that? And my daughter raised her hand. He said, "Carrie, you know Jabberwocky?" And she said, "'Twas brillig and the slithy toves." She retold the whole poem.
Oh, my gosh.
And she said, "Miss Campbell asked me where I heard this or where I learned this." And she said, "Oh, my father used to read me to sleep at night with that. I hated it." But she caught it. And so the point I want to make is, of course, in your book, Poetry Speaks to Children, one of the poems that you have anthologized is Lewis Carroll's Jabberwocky. But there's many others in here that people are going to be familiar with if they did what I did, which is to read to their kids, because mm-hmm. they're wonderful poems, mm-hmm. and just going through a few of them. Who do you have there?
Well, again, you know, one of our goals with these anthologies, the Poetry Speaks anthologies, and I think throughout, whenever I edit an anthology, is to try to expose the reader or the public to a wide range of poets.
Mm-hmm.
So to try to get the historic range, to have, you know, in Poetry Speaks, I think both Poetry Speaks Who I Am and Poetry Speaks to Children, we've got Shakespeare, we have Dickinson. In Poetry Speaks to Children, there's Yeats, Robert Frost. So we have the great poets of our time, along with our great living poets. So we have poets such as Seamus Heaney, W.S. Merwin, Rita Dove, Maxine Kuman. And what is unusual about the series is that you can actually hear the poets reading the poems in their own voices.
And that was great. So absolutely
great.
There's
a CD, and you can play the poems. And when our children were little, we would play the CD, and they would listen to the CD, and they were just learning how to read. So they would memorize the poem, and then look at the page and remember the poem in their head, and then read the poem on the page and sort of put the words and the sounds together.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it was a great teaching tool for kids,
mm-hmm.
and just a great way, again, for, you know, all members of the family to communicate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing now with Poetry Speaks Who I Am, which is a book for these tweens, is we're touching on subjects that you may feel uncomfortable talking about with your kids. So there's a poem about, you know, your first bra. There's a poem about parents getting divorced. There's a poem about hating your mother, loving your mother. And so, again, I think I like the way you described it earlier, is just opening up ways of communication.
Mm-hmm.
So having a way to communicate with little children with Poetry Speaks to Children, and now with children from 12 to 14 years old with Poetry Speaks Who I Am.
You know, the great people that I've run across in my reading or my life are the ones who can take that moment or an insight and to express it simply and clearly. Mm-hmm. In a way that communicates the insight. I always say we have some wonderful, great, brilliant people in our Plato, Aristotle, and great thinkers. And I always think that their brilliance is in having this vision. They see a vision of reality, or as they perceive it, and it's a gosh moment. Oh my gosh, it's beautiful. I understand mm-hmm. it now. Mm-hmm. And then they turn around and they try to explain it. And as soon as you use words to explain any insight or any emotion, it begins to get fragile mm-hmm. because no mm-hmm. word can fully express the word love. No word can fully express what love, all the different aspects of love. But I think that one of the things about poetry, on the other hand, is you are not necessarily stuck with the parameters of an English sentence. You use the words as a way of capturing, and it's positioning, capturing an emotion or an insight mm-hmm. that perhaps is not possible as easily with the full sentence paragraph mm-hmm. of a novel mm-hmm. or of an mm-hmm. essay.
I think you're absolutely right, yes.
I found a poem in here which of my own life. One of the poets that I love the most is Robert Frost, and mm-hmm. you've got "Stopping by the Woods," and it's a great poem to convey a feeling, mm-hmm. an instant, mm-hmm. And it's memorable. Mm-hmm. It's easy to remember, and it's got repetition, and it's American. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's great. And I'm glad that you have that in here. I'm glad you have Langston Hughes. I read Langston Hughes' poetry, a poem in this, and was excellent. That would really struck me, that Langston Hughes. Would you, to see if you can pull that out and just read? This is a poem that speaks to what the instinct, the intuition that all people are human, whether they are black or white, they have a common bond. And I think that in this particular poem, Langston Hughes brings some of that together. Could you read that?
Yeah, and also what I love about this poem is that it was one of the very first poems he wrote. He was 18 years old when he wrote this poem, and I had this great experience. This actually, I think I may have included in Poetry Speaks, the revised version, but I was at Yale looking up manuscripts because we have, do you have that anthology over there somewhere? The Poetry
yes.
Speaks way? I mean, Poetry Speaks anthology. I was looking up archival material for Poetry Speaks, and I remember finding a scrap of paper, and Langston Hughes had scribbled "The Negro Speaks of Rivers" on this piece of paper, and he had done that so that he could recite the poem. You know, he had recited it. I think what had happened was, and I'm going to look this up in this other book, and then I'll read you the poem. Is that he was on a radio station, and I think that the person that was talking to Langston Hughes asked him to recite the poem, and I've just found it now. It's in his handwriting, and he wrote, "From memory to read on radio station." So this is a poem that I feel very strongly about and very, very moved by, since he wrote this as a young man. And if you have a chance to get Poetry Speaks to children, you'll be able to actually hear Langston Hughes read it aloud himself and hear what he has to say about writing the poem. "The Negro Speaks of Rivers. I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers.
Here's a man. Talk about taking an instant. Here's a man by a river, reflecting on how rivers are a part of his soul.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes in, he extends himself over the history of civilization,
mm-hmm.
Africa, Egypt, the Congo, the Nile, and he brings it up. He ties together American history, and he leaves it. The package he leaves with you with is when you go to the river, your destiny, your history is there as well. I think it's a fascinating poem. Now, we are going to focus on Elise Passion after we take a break. We're talking to Elise Passion, poet, in fact, the Poet Laureate of Three Oaks. We'll be right back. We're now back with Elise Passion, who is a poet and, as I said, the Poet Laureate of Three Oaks. Now, we've talked a lot about her background, her family, her interest in poetry, a communicator of poetry. We know she's a teacher as well, but she's also a poet. So I've asked you to read a couple of your poems, and if you have another poem you'd like to read that you think is really close to your heart, please do. But if you'd read the ones, now you've got two books of your own poetry. One is called Bestiary, and another book is called Infidelities. And you can find these books, I'm sure, in both bookstores, quality bookstores around the country and around the area. But if you would tell us about the poem that I picked there,
mm-hmm.
in Bestiary, and then if you could tell us why and what brought it about, and then read it to us.
And Bestiary was just published last year by Red Hen Press, and Infidelities came out in 1996, won the Nicholas Roark Poetry Prize, and then there was a chapbook that came out actually when I was at Oxford called House's Coast, but that one's harder to find. This poem that John, that you've asked me to read, is called Hive, and many of the poems in this latest book were inspired by human experience, gestation, birth, being a parent, being an adult, and one's parents getting older, death. So there's a wide range of poems that are covered. And also, I think one thing I should mention is that as a writer, I'm very interested in the tradition of the English language. So most of my poems are written in some sort of metric form or some sort of form. So this one is in couplets, and it's called Hive, and it was inspired by our son when he was little. Tucked in a cleft of arm, you hunt for milk, roseate, areola. I circumnavigate the signs pictured on your pajamas. Arrows point east and west. A violet hive. Bear. Tail end up in honeypot. Cars drone outside. I comb back tufts of hair. We burrow in these chintz pillows. Sink deeply down in sofa. For now, we are a pair spied on by animals. A rabbit pokes its ear, antenna-like, from under cushions. I've read, during the summer honey flow, worker bees will travel 55,000 miles to gather nectar to make 1 pound of honey. A foot kicks off its sock. You sip, roaming many miles, honey seeker. Days tumble. I would like to buzz into the orchid of your ear. And one thing I'd like to say about this poem is it was first published by Ed Byrne, who edits Valparaiso Poetry Review. And I think he chose that poem.
I think it is a wonderful poem. It is very evocative. As a guy, it puts me in back, sort of in my mother's arms. Mm. And it allows me to see what the other side was thinking when I was there.
Mm. You know,
Now, there is another poem, which is in your book, Infidelities. And I think I'm going to try to do this with you.
Okay.
It's called Passage 2. All right? So let's try it. It's written in question and answer form, but it's a poem.
And if I could also just set this poem up a little bit, when I was working on this book, Infidelities, which came out in 1996, I had the great fortune again to work with the poet Frank Bidart. And we were putting together, it takes me a long time to write a book of poems, about 10 years between each mm-hmm. book. And he was looking at the manuscript and he'd seen poems that I'd written at Harvard and then in graduate school. And he had suggested, I have a poem named Passage that was written when I was living in England, and he had suggested that I write this poem, Passage 2. And it is in this dialogue form as Passage was written as well.
Where is the man?
Watching the woman sleep.
What does he see?
A girl cross-legged, arm's length from the TV, observing a world in miniature, as if it were a diorama or snow-filled paperweight. Her mother's on the screen, on stage, in gauze, in air, a firebird, a sugar plum fairy, receiving roses from another daughter, her daughter's age. The governess turns off the set. The mother phones her daughter, who says, "Oh, mother, why can't I be that girl on the stage placing red roses in your hands?"
Where does the woman sleep?
Inside her mother's room. But when she sleeps, she sees a man who stands beside her bed about to kill her. He is holding a gun against her head. She runs before he pulls the trigger.
When will she end her dream?
When she stops sleeping inside her mother's room.
Where's the man?
Watching her sleep.
Powerful. Do I see the young Elise Passion and looking at Maria Tallchief on television?
Yes, that was based on a true story.
Yeah.
That my mother would relate that I was watching her on TV. I don't really remember it, but she's the one that did tell me this story. And it's, again, interesting how art reflects reality and then reality reflects art, that you'll hear a story and then you can translate that story into a poem, and then the poem becomes the story. So it's, again, how can you capture time, and how can you, as an adult, you know, what is, it may not be necessarily the truth, but suddenly it becomes the truth because it becomes the poem.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
Now, in addition to your other skills, now there's a very important one for this area, which is you are also the Poet Laureate of Three Oaks. Now, that is a title which I'm sure is at the top of your bio.
Yes.
I mean, all the rest of this is just irrelevant, you know, it just gets you to this point.
Right.
But in that role, and you do, how did that come about?
Well, I have had the good fortune to know Alan Turner mm-hmm. for many years. I first met him at the Newberry Library. I had a fellowship at the Newberry Library, and Alan was on the board. And he was there when I gave a presentation about the Osage Reign of Terror. I was trying to work on it. I ended up as a poem. Maybe it'll be a full-length book one day. And then working with Alan at the Poetry Center and working with Alan through a dear friend of ours, Richard Famray, who would put together poetry and music. I actually came out here to Three Oaks and did several events where my poems were set to music. And during one of those events, I met the then current Poet Laureate, the then Poet Laureate of Three Oaks. And when we moved here, I mentioned to Alan's daughter, Jenny, oh, we just bought a house. Am I eligible? Is it possible to apply? And she found out what I needed to do, and I submitted my poems, and I was nominated or selected as the Poet Laureate. As the Poet Laureate of Three Oaks, you have duties to perform.
All right.
And one of them is to write a Flag Day poem.
Okay.
Which I did, and I recited that at Flag Day a couple of years ago. And you also need to write a winter poem. And that poem is included in Bestiary. It's called Pond in Winter, and it is a favorite poem of mine. And one of the most recent requests was to write an ode to Three Oaks. So as I explained before the show, I've written this poem. I'm still working on the poem. So when you see it in print, it may not look the way it will now read as I read it out loud. Because as I said, I do revise quite a lot.
Would you read it?
Yes. So all of you who live in Three Oaks may recognize some of the names in the poem. Three Oaks. Alan suggested writing a poem about the town of Three Oaks, Michigan, where walking down Elm Street, you can imagine plank sidewalks, the saplings newly planted, flags shining, candy flying, the expectation of banners, trumpets, horns for the Flag Day parade, a village once transformed by a practical turkey quill, whose library stands august beside the tracks, across from Vickers Theater, down the street from the former Featherbone Factory, now the Acorn Theater, around the corner from the Dewey Cannon Park, where, from the gazebo on Saturday nights, concerts resound while the green grass is strewn with bright-colored blankets. A town where an outing consists of a visit to Froelich's or the all-purpose pharmacy for anything you need. Driving down Elm, you enter another time, the shops and galleries like beacons scattered along the street, the generosity of each citizen, how Martha at Opulence Antiques offered to lend the region of Three Oaks when my copy could not be found, how at B Books, Rick suggested violas, commenting, "It's hard to write a poem on demand." And how, after closing, Mike at Viola's offered to leave the history of Three Oaks on his porch. How, when I called Dreyer's Butcher looking for inspiration, Caroline, the store's owner, read out loud the ode Carl Sandburg's daughter, Helga, wrote about bologna. And we both shared a laugh. Three Oaks, a town where once three oak trees towered high for trains. Keep stretching out your wings.
Three Oaks produced Robert Hellinga, who is an author, a novelist, and a professor of English literature at Knox College, and a former guest on the show, produced Carl Sandburg in this area, a great poet. Fog creeps in on little cat's feet was the one line I remember of his poem on fog. Mm-hmm. And now it's produced you. Or you are adopted
yes.
child
yes.
of this area. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this. This has been really a great experience talking to you. I like your poetry. I like your communication skills and your passion for poetry. I wish you the best. Before we go, do you have a website?
I do. It's elisepassion.com.
Spell that for us, please, the passion part.
It's elisepassion.com.
All one word, no dots in the middle.
Exactly.
Okay. And from that, you might be able to find, or a reader might be able to find, where they might get some of your books, your anthologies. In a nonprofit radio station, I cannot urge people to buy these books. But I can suggest that if you read the content of these poems, you will be the better person for them. The name of our program is With Respect. Our guest today has been Elise Passion. Elise, thank you very much for joining us. I really enjoyed it, and I'm sure our listeners have as well.
Thank you so much. It was a great pleasure to be here.
Our program, With Respect, is on every Sunday morning at 11 and every Thursday morning at 10. And as I say every week, remember that if you show respect, respect will be shown to you.